If you love this podcast and IPR, you probably know that it's fueled by listener dollars. Hi, I'm Rick Brewer, a talk show producer at Iowa Public Radio. And part of my job is connecting with Iowans who have stories to tell. When you contribute to IPR, you help make that possible. Membership contributions make up 57% of IPR's budget. That's huge and amazing. So do your part to support the podcast and programs you enjoy. Go to iowapublicradio.org and tap the red donate button. Thank you.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Summer is here, and hopefully it brings with it time to dig into a good book, or several. This hour, one of my favorite shows of the year, we'll get book recommendations from some of Iowa's leading independent booksellers. Jan Weissmiller and Tim Budd of Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City are here. Hello, Jan.
Hello, Charity.
And hello, Tim.
Good morning.
And Hunter Gillum of Beaverdale Books is on the line. Hello, Hunter.
Hello.
Thank you all so much for being here today. And for, like I said, I'm excited. I have suddenly found a renewed appetite for reading voraciously after kind of a year of brain fog. I'm ready to read all of these books. So, Jan, why don't you help me make my list? What is number one on your list for fiction?
Number one for me is Filthy Animals, a collection of short stories by Brandon Taylor, whose novel Real Life was shortlisted for the Booker Prize last year. And it actually comes out on Tuesday, so you'll have to wait until Tuesday.
Well, and Brandon is going to be on Talk of Iowa next Thursday.
Wonderful. So. And I think he's also going to be on... What's the NPR Weekend Show? Weekend Edition.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah.
That's great news.
Yeah.
So tell me about the collection.
Well, if you read Real Life, I think you will recognize some of the stories are linked, I should say, that there are, I think, three or four stories with the same characters who are Lionel, Charles, and Sophie. And Charles and Sophie are dancers. They're all college students, again in Wisconsin. And Lionel will be familiar to you as Wallace probably, but they are a wonderful trio. Brandon, who lives here, I was talking to him about it, and I said, Sophie is so great. And Brandon said, yeah, I know. Sophie always gets all the best lines.
Oh, that's great. Well, and a short story collection is such a great thing to dip into and carry with you, even if you don't have time to dig through a whole novel.
That is true. Although I'm with this book, I actually did read it just like a novel.
Nice. Nice. All right. Well, Tim, I'll let you go next. What's first on your list?
Well, I don't know if I could choose a first. I mean, I think they're all equally good. But I will start with The Once and Future Witches by Alix. That's A-L-I-X E. Harrow. This is a young writer, her second novel, and I would recommend her first one as well, The 10,000 Doors of January. She's a fantasy writer, and The Once and Future Witches is set in 1893 and follows the three Eastwood sisters who are reunited. They kind of had a falling out 7 years ago. They have a very abusive father, so their childhood was not good. But they're reunited, and the youngest one joins the suffrage movement. We're in Massachusetts in 1893, but when they aren't allowed permits to protest or parade or even the vote, they decide to resurrect witchcraft. Now, the reason this works, and I know it's kind of, it seems preposterous, the reason it works is because it's set in New Salem, because Old Salem was razed after the Salem witchcraft trials. And everyone in New Salem believes in witchcraft, so they know it is real. And she's done some wonderful, interesting things. She posits the idea that women know this stuff because it's all set in those things your mother told you. A stitch in time saves nine is actually part of a spell. Women wove these into samplers. They kept this hidden. So it is a wonderful feminist book. And when things don't go their way, they use their witchcraft to let men know they are unhappy. So there's a real modern sensibility of the Me Too movement in here. It is very high fantasy, but she makes it work. And it is a wonderful escapist novel.
It sounds like it could be very cathartic depending on where you stand right now.
It is.
All right. The Once and Future Witches by Alix E. Harrow. And that brings us to you, Hunter. What do you want to start with?
So I'll start with Abundance by Jacob Guanzin, which is a novel that follows a father and son as they deal with being homeless and poor. And sort of the unique part about it is it's the chapters... the title of is how much money they have, And so sometimes, you know, it's a lot lower, and other times it's a lot higher, and it's told in flashback for a lot of it. And so you open and you know that they're homeless and they don't have much money, but then subsequent chapters they'll have more money, and so then you kind of get to see sort of their decline as you're sort of hoping for their rebound. And I just thought, yeah, it's sort of an important book. A lot of books deal with class as an issue, and I think that this one really dives into kind of the nuts and bolts of it, and the dad is constantly doing mental math as far as how much money he's going to make on a job, and then how much he's going to have to drive, and how much that's going to cost him in gas, and, you know, their meals and stuff. And so I just thought it was a fantastic book, and you sort of are just, as the reader, thrust into their situation and kind of are feeling the, you know, the kind of the system working against them at times. I just thought it was, yeah, a really powerful book.
Oh, great. Abundance, a novel by Jacob Gwanson. And that brings us back around to you, Jan.
Well, I have Great Circle by Maggie Shipstead, and it is it's a long, great read. And it
if you heard that thump, that's because it's a substantial book.
Yeah, if you're going on a vacation, like, you know, even 10 days, you could take it and it would probably last you. Although it's pretty hard to put down, so maybe not. But anyway, its protagonist is this woman named Marion Graves, and she is rescued with her twin brother from a ship sort of like the Titanic in 1914. Her father is like the captain of the ship, and he saves these six-month-old children who have lost their mother instead of other passengers on the ship, and so he goes to jail. And they're sent to Montana to live with their sort of on-again, off-again alcoholic painter uncle, and to sort of fend for themselves. And they befriend a young Native American named Caleb, and that relationship lasts through their lives. But Marion becomes introduced to flying when she's 10. And so it becomes her dream to fly. And the book is really about the saga of a woman flying at that time. And she's not supposed to be Amelia Earhart, because Amelia Earhart comes up as a character. She's influenced by Amelia Earhart, but she marries a bootlegger, she goes to Canada, she goes to Alaska, she goes to Antarctica. She is a pilot during World War II and forms another very interesting relationship with a gay man who marries her to cover during that period of her life. And then this sort of amazing story of Marion's life is interspersed with chapters whose narrator is an actress in her 20s in 2014 in L.A., playing her in a movie.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, that sounds like the perfect vacation read, doesn't it?
It's really good. And Maggie she's probably in her late 30s, and she's written for Outsider magazine, so she's been in a lot of these places, which makes, I think, the landscape writing quite remarkable.
Nice. All right. Great Circle by Maggie Shipstead. Sounds like quite the saga. And that brings us back to you, Tim.
The next novel, like a mystery, We Begin at the End. It's such a very enigmatic title. We Begin at the End by Chris Whitaker. It is set in a small coastal touristy California town. The cliffside is eroding, and it really... The gist of this novel is the characters Chris Whitaker has created, who will haunt you for months. I cannot shake them. But it basically follows four characters: Vincent King, his best friend Walker, and they just call him Walker. That's his last name. I don't think they even tell you what his first name is in the book. Vincent's girlfriend Star, and Walker's girlfriend Martha. And this foursome is a high school foursome. And one night there is a terrible event, and Vincent is sent to jail for the next 30 years. That's in the beginning of the book. And now it's 30 years later, Vincent's being released and coming back to this small California town. And that event has changed all their lives. Walker is now the town sheriff. Star, Vincent's girlfriend, is kind of a drunk, has two children from different fathers. And Marcia, Walker's girlfriend, has since moved away to a neighboring town and is a domestic abuse and a child support lawyer. So Vincent's come back home after 30 years, and everyone has this history. Everyone has this baggage, not sure how they feel about him coming back. And suddenly there's a murder in town, and everyone just assumes it's Vincent. Why wouldn't it be? But it is the characters. I mean, you have the dual mystery of what happened 30 years ago and what happened today. But it's the characters and their interaction and their sort of hardscrabble way of connecting and loving each other. Star has two children, and Duchess is 13, and she really pretty much runs the family. And this 13-year-old girl is a character who will stay with you for a long time. They have the unfortunate last name of Radley, so a lot of people have compared her to Scout, but I think they are nothing alike. She is called into the principal's office for calling a kid at school. She said, "If you touch my little brother again, I will take your head off. Expletive." And she looked at the principal and said, "I never said expletive. You know, I said this." So she's pretty scrappy. But what's interesting about this book is that Chris Whitaker, the author, is British. He doesn't live in London. He lives in the country. But he sets his novels in America because of our gun laws.
Oh.
And that is something we should all be thinking about when we read this book, that a foreign author would put his books here just because it's the Wild West, I guess, in a way. But I will tell you, it is a thoroughly wonderful, engrossing read. And these characters are magnificent.
We Begin at the End by Chris Whitaker. And Hunter, that brings us back to you. We only have about a minute and a half before the break, so if we have to continue after, that's all right. But what's next on your list?
Okay, yeah. So I got The Thousand Crimes of Ming Su by Tom Lin, which is a Western focusing where the main character is of Chinese descent, which is sort of unique for the genre. And he is an orphan who is raised by like a leader of a crime syndicate in California. And, you know, as he's trying to elope with his wife, her father kind of steals her back, which then the rest of the book is basically him trying to get revenge on the people that have wronged him. And then along the way, you know, he meets a prophet that is blind and clairvoyant and can tell people when they're supposed to die, and you know, Ming is somebody who has passed the day of where he was supposed to die, and so then the prophet doesn't know kind of why he's still around, and it's sort of just him going around, you know, trying to enact revenge on all of the people. So it has a lot of the similar, like the basic tropes of a Western, but dealing with having somebody be of Asian descent, I think, is important.
That sounds fun. We are going to have to take a break. This is Thousand Crimes of Ming Su by Tom Lin. We'll continue in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa.
The way you get your news may have changed during this pandemic, but you still need to know what's going on in our state every day. Iowa Public Radio News has you covered. Subscribe to our new podcast, Hear First, and start your day equipped with the essential local news you need to know, delivered in under 15 minutes, weekdays by 7 a.m. Get analysis from IPR's team of reporters, learn about what's going on at the Statehouse and on the ground in your community. Subscribe to Hear First today wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Debbie. Our summer books show today. With me in the studio, I have Jan Weissmiller and Tim Budd of Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City. Hunter Gillum of Beaverdale Books is on the line. They are sharing their lists. We're talking fiction so far. And of course, we will share these lists on our website, iowapublicradio.org. And Hunter, we just finished talking about Thousand Crimes of Ming Su by Tom Lin. So it's a Western. It's got some mysticism, some fantasy in there, and it sounds like it kind of turns the genre on its head a little bit.
Yeah.
All right.
Definitely. I liked it a lot.
Sounds like a nice escape for sure. All right. Back to you, Jan. What's next?
Well, so I have another collection of short stories by Elizabeth McCracken, who is wonderful. We love her. And she's it's called The Souvenir Museum. And the first story is just, I think, maybe the most autobiographical. Well, she did write a memoir, but other than that, it might be the most autobiographical thing she's ever written, I think, because it's about a young woman who goes to Ireland with her English husband to meet his family for the first time, and they are truly crazy. They're they're going for the wedding of one of his sisters, and they're told when they get there that the mother is not coming because she has gout. But then it turns out that she doesn't have gout; she's just refusing to go because her daughter has switched to Catholicism and is marrying an atheist.
Or gout. These are so similar, right?
but there's a lot of kind of sweetness about how the young man has to deal with both his family and the woman that he will eventually marry in this same setting. But man, is it a funny story.
Oh.
And then there are others. And she's never without humor, but she's also very tender. And there's a story about a widower and his adult son going to look for puffins, and that's a very touching story, but also quite funny, and you can never go wrong with Elizabeth McCracken.
All right, I'm going to have to take the rest of the summer off to read all of these books. The Souvenir Museum Stories by Elizabeth McCracken, and that brings us back to you, Tim.
The next one is the new novel from Andy Weir, the author of The Martian. People will probably recognize that title. The new book is called Project Hail Mary, and it is really a great summer read. He has that trademark humor that he has. This time around, we're following Ryland Grace, a middle school science teacher who wakes up out of a very long sleep, finds he is alone on a spaceship with no memory of how he got there. That is one of the side effects of being put into hypersleep so you can travel great distances. So interspersed with what's happening on the ship, you get the flashbacks of his memory returning. So you get the story on Earth that has led to him being on this spaceship. And then you get what's happening on the spaceship. Suffice it to say, he is on a journey, and I don't think I'm spoiling anything because it's on the jacket. The other crew members did not survive, so he's on his own. He is way out in deep space trying to find a way to save the planet Earth because something, the sun is dimming and it will become too cold and life on Earth will be kaput. So there he is out in space trying to save the planet. And he comes to find out that he is not alone out in deep space. And I think I will just leave it there. But it is coming in at just under 500 pages. It is a whopper. And it's a great summer read. And again, you have all the science and math you could ever hope to have in a book.
Nice. And you just helped me decide what I'm getting my husband for Father's Day.
Oh,
don't worry. He's not listening. That's Project Hail Mary by Andy Weir. And Hunter, we're back to you.
So I have The Sweetness of Water by Nathan Harris, which just came out yesterday. And it takes place in Georgia just after the Civil War, and the Emancipation Proclamation has been signed. And this landowner, George, and his wife, Isabel, they hire two brothers to come and help work the land, and you know they end up planting peanuts and stuff there, and which causes kind of an uproar within their community because there were other people looking for work, returning soldiers, and they had hired these two, former slaves to work for a wage, and they're saving up so that they can go north in hopes of finding their mother that they were, and she was sold when they were children, and. So and they kind of form a bond early on that is sort of unexpected. And then alongside that, there's the story of two Confederate soldiers that are kind of having a romance together. And I don't want to give too much away, but it's just really good. A lot of stuff happens. You get to all the kind of the town politics and the relationship between George, who seems kind of like this hard-nosed, southern farmer, and just the tenderness she shows to these brothers and all their hopes and aspirations now that they are free to be able to earn money and earn a decent wage. I mean, he was paying them what he would pay anybody else, kind of what the going rate for labor was. So it's a beautifully told story. Very good.
And I see that it is an Oprah Book Club pick. I see a blurb from Richard Russo. I'm getting the feeling, Hunter, that if you want to be the person who's read the book that everybody's going to be talking about in a few weeks, you should pick this one up right now. Am I right about that?
At the time, I read it before, it was announced as the Oprah Book Club pick, but I think that people would have been drawn to this eventually anyway. But this, I think, kind of just expedites the all of that.
All right. So, and if you want to be the one telling everybody to read it,
exactly.
You get on it right now.
You got to get out in front of
it. Be ahead of the curve. Perfect. Mm-hmm. Sweetness of Water by Nathan Harris. And Jan, it's your turn again.
Well, so this I'm going to talk about a novel that is not new called The Great Fire by Shirley Hazard. It was it won the National Book Award in 2003, but I don't remember it as being such a big deal, even though it won. It was probably a surprise choice at the time. But she has gotten – Shirley Hazard was an Australian-American author who – was born in 1931 and died in 2016. And in 1983, she wrote a novel called Transit of Venus that became this sort of cult classic. And this summer, it was reissued by Penguin, and she got a lot of attention again in the New York Review of Books and the New York Times. And Lauren Groff wrote the new introduction to Transit of Venus. And so a friend of mine read this Great Fire, and she said, I think it's better. Well, I'm not comparing them. They're very different things. And so she convinced me to read it, and I read it. And I loved it. And the difference between it and Transit of Venus is probably not quite the tour de force that Transit of Venus is, but it is so beautiful. And such a love story. And the narrator or the protagonist is Aldred Leith, and he is a World War II hero in his early 30s. And he is in China and Japan after World War II, still working for the government. And actually, he's left China and just gone to Japan as the novel begins. And he's supposed to be reporting on what actually happened at Hiroshima, although that is clearly in the back. I mean, there's no visceral reporting on that. I mean, there are it infiltrates the book, but not directly, which is an interesting strategy, actually. Mm-hmm. But what the plot then really becomes about is, and it is sort of a diffuse plot. I mean, it's one of those novels that you read partly for the beauty of the writing. But anyway, they interlink. He meets these Australian twins, brother and sister. The brother is very sick. They're 17. He falls in love with a girl, but he's very, very careful. I mean, and so the novel goes on while he waits for her to get older, while he makes sure that he's not pushing himself on her in any way. It's just really beautiful. And in the course of that, he goes back. His father dies. His father had been a famous novelist, sort of a jerk in England, and he goes back to see his father, re-encounters a woman that had been both he and his father's lover, his first lover that his father stole from him. And, you know, there's just all this, but it isn't melodramatic ever. It's a truly beautiful novel. And when you finish it, I read it again. It's one of those books where, you know, it's complex enough and beautiful enough that when you finish it, you really do want to read it again just to see how it all fits together.
Oh, wow. Well, Dan, I'm trying to remember the last time I saw you this in love with a book.
Did love this book.
All right. Everyone should read this because Jan has excellent taste. Great Fire by Shirley Hazard. And it's in paperback, so that's
right.
Convenient as
it's
well.
Light.
Nice. All right. That brings us back to you, Tim.
The next novel I'd like to talk about, and this kind of follows up on Hunter's last pick, this is called The Prophets by Robert Jones Jr. And Robert Jones Jr. is a New Yorker. It's his first novel. He's got a lot of buzz. The top 10 black writers to watch and all kinds of lists. And I thought, really? And it's definitely warranted. Many people are comparing him to Toni Morrison, and the writing is of that style. The writing is very earthy and majestic and new, and I'm still trying to process a lot of the novel because it's so rich. And I don't know what the title refers to necessarily, The Prophets, but it is set in on a cotton plantation in the early 1830s in Mississippi, and all of that plantation world, the brutality of the slave life. It is told from various perspectives, including the white folks, the owners, and as well as the slaves. Almost everyone has biblical names, and the structure of the book is that each chapter has a biblical chapter name, like Corinthians or, you know, Song of Songs or Lamentations, whatever. And then interspersed in that, there are chapters who I believe are the voices of ancestors. So basically, it is the love story of two slaves, Isaiah and Samuel, who live in the barn and tend the farm animals. And everyone knows about their love, but, you know, don't really care. And the fact that it's such a beautiful story, their relationship, and the fact that this beautiful love story exists in the middle of this brutality, of this world that has no hope, has no optimism, but they found this one beautiful thing in each other. And of course, that can't last because of the slave owner is upset that they will not produce offspring when he tries to mate them. The other slave girls, they're not interested in them. And how can this thing be? It has to be spoiled. So it is a novel of hope nonetheless, but the writing, the connection between Africa and now, and those things that must not be lost and must be saved, and what's in a name. I mean, it is such a rich, beautiful book that's perfect for Gay Pride. It's perfect for Juneteenth. It is great summer read. And I think I need to read it again because there's so much in there that I just don't think I've gotten it all.
All right. Well, that's a powerful recommendation to The Prophets by Robert Jones Jr. And that brings us back to you, Hunter.
All right. So I had The Night Always Comes by Willie Lawton, which is a gritty book that had at times feels sort of like the sort of southern noir of like Danny Woodrell and the Winter's Bone, but it takes place in the Pacific Northwest around Portland. And it feels like Woodrell because he just gets the sort of the underbelly of the city and stuff like that in the same way that Woodrell would write about the Ozarks. And it focuses around a family and it's a daughter and her brother who is like developmentally disabled and their mother. And she's trying to be able to purchase their house that is run down, but because it's close to, it's, you know, in Portland, the price of it is really high, and their landlord was going to give them a deal on it. So she's sort of sees this as their last chance to be able to buy a house. And then right before it was supposed to close, the mom decides that she's going to back out of the sale and doesn't want to live there. And so then the daughter starts in a mad rush to just try to make up the rest of the money. And, you know, most of the book takes place in the middle of the night as she is running around trying to do whatever she can to be able to secure this sort of what she views as the American dream and kind of just what people would do to get, like, the lengths people go to you know, see their families. She's always kind of like looking out for her brother and stuff too, and wants to do this as much for herself as to be able to help out her brother as well. And it's just really good, very fast paced kind of literary thriller. But gets a lot of these different, you just get a look at how Portland is changing. What is that doing to the people that have lived there, for, you know, a long period of time, and they're watching, you know, their houses, their neighbors' houses get bought for millions of dollars and then demolished to build, you know, apartments, buildings and stuff like that. So, but it was, yeah, very good.
All right. The Night Always Comes by Willie Vlauten. And very quickly, we've got about 3 minutes. Can we get through three more fiction picks? Can you do a fast one, Jan?
I'll go really fast. Okay. I've got the Uncollected Stories of Alan Gurganus, and I don't know, you know, he's not super well known, but he's most famous for a very long novel, The Oldest Confederate Widow Tells All, and he's Southern, although he did go to the Writers' Workshop. And this book, unlike many of his collections of short stories, these are not set in North Carolina, where he's from, predominantly. They're set other places, and this book in particular has been getting attention because the first story is about a young student at the University of Iowa in 1973 that discovers a portrait in a junk shop. And it turns out to be the portrait of a country doctor who had predicted a plague in 1849. And it came out like the year before the pandemic. And so it's gotten this, you know, prescient.
Yeah, yeah.
But he's a great writer. I mean, he can't resist an aside, but neither can you resist them, reading them.
All right. The Uncollected Stories of Alan Gurganus. And Tim, quickly?
The next book I've chosen is called The Removed by Brandon Hobson. His last novel before this, Where the Dead Sit Talking, was a finalist for the National Book Award. It is a family story set in Oklahoma. The author is a member of the Cherokee tribe, as are the characters in the book. A mother and father and their two adult children, who the mother is trying to gather together for their annual Labor Day bonfire while they remember and honor the death of the oldest son 15 years ago, who was killed by police in a very unfortunate tragedy. But it is, in his books, it's a lot of Cherokee folklore, and the real world and the spiritual world rub up against each other all the time. So I had to learn a lot about Cherokee folklore to understand what was happening. And it is a book that you need to read with someone because you want to talk about it, because there are some things that you're just not sure of what really happened there. But so it warrants a lot of discussion, and it has you believe in there's another realm out there, and it touches us occasionally. And it's a very interesting novel in that regard, that we are not alone.
All right. So read it with a friend.
Right.
Who's going to talk it over with you. The Removed by Brandon Hobson. And we'll get your final lightning round fiction pick after the break, Hunter. And then we'll move into nonfiction as well. We are talking about the best new books this summer. We've been focusing on fiction so far. Again, these lists will be up on iowapublicradio.org eventually. And we'll also share those out through social media. With me today, Jan Weissmiller and Tim Budd, Prairie Lights Book Store in Iowa City, and Hunter Gillum of Beaverdale Books. This is Talk of Iowa.
In a time like none of us have experienced before, there's strength to be found in community institutions like Iowa Public Radio. I'm Executive Director Myrna Johnson, and I'm so proud of the thoughtful, informed coverage IPR brings you on the issues that matter. Listener funding is the power source that makes it all possible. Facts, understanding, insight. That's what you fund when you give to this station. Make your gift now at iowapublicradio.org, and thank you.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. We are talking about the best new books this summer with some of Iowa's leading independent booksellers. Jan Weissmiller and Tim Budd of Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City are here. Hunter Gillum of Beaverdale Books is on the line. And Hunter, your final fiction pick. What do you want to talk about?
I'll talk about The Five Wounds by Kristen Valdez-Quaid, which takes place in New Mexico, and it is just told it's for a full calendar year and follows a family, and it starts on Good Friday and ends on Good Friday, and it sort of follows Amadeo is the dad who is dealing with his kind of the consequences of his past mistakes and is dealing with alcoholism. And part of the way he's dealing with that is he is part of this Good Friday kind of Easter procession. He is, you know, carries a cross like Jesus, and it's complete with getting nail driven through his hands, which is supposed to somehow help him, you know, with his spiritual side, to help him get over his alcoholism. And then while that is happening, his sort of estranged daughter, Angel, who is very pregnant at the time, shows up at his house because she's had a falling out with with her mother. And at the same time, it's Amadeo's mother, Angel's grandmother, who is where they are all staying at. And then she has some medical issues that she doesn't really tell her family and kind of decides to keep private. And so the whole novel, you kind of get their own personal insights, but then also how they're all sort of connecting as a family and changing. And Amadeo is kind of reconnecting with his daughter. It's really good.
All right. Five Wounds by Kristen Valdez-Quaid. That very, very intriguing. Now we're going to move into nonfiction, and we are not going to have time to get through this entire list, but let's give it a try. Where do you want to start, Jan?
Well, I'm going to start with a book that I actually just finished. And it is, again, 750 pages long. But you don't have...
Sometimes you need to log all your pages, Jan. That's amazing.
It isn't. I did read it cover to cover, but you wouldn't have to. It's called The Free World, Art and Thought in the Cold War, and it's by Louis Menand, who reviews for The New Yorker and is a Pulitzer Prize winner for his book on late 19th century, early 20th century philosophy, The Metaphysical Club. But this book is about the period – the Cold War actually was started in 1947. Some speech that Truman gave was what sort of, you know – maybe not kicked it off, but defined it, and is really said to have lasted through 1989, although the book really doesn't go beyond Watergate. But he isn't really trying to give us a political history of the Cold War or talk about what the Cold War means to the current moment. He's just talking about everything that happened in art and thought and politics. And the reason that I said that you could read it without reading it cover to cover is because he made the choice not to try and make these things the influences of each other.
Oh,
they aren't the causes of each other.
They're treated just separately.
Yeah. And although you see how it's all going on, it's probably more realistic than trying to. But anyway, I just thought it was wonderful. There was amazing stuff about the art world, obviously, about abstract expressionism. And he knew the whole story about Peggy Guggenheim giving the Pollock to the University of Iowa. But he also knew something or described something that I had never known, and it was our mural, the painting that we have of Jackson Pollock's, that caused Clement Greenberg to say that Jackson Pollock was the most important painter since Moreau, and really, you know, set the whole stage for what then happened with Jackson Pollock. But there's amazing stuff about the women's movement. He goes in depth about Betty Friedan, and which I guess I read The Feminine Mystique in college, but I never really knew her background, which was really very interesting because she was not hurting when she wrote that book. It was 1963. She was married to a wealthy man. She was freelancing for newspapers. She sort of had a life. But she decided to ask her Smith College classmates how they were feeling about their lives 15 years after they'd graduated, and they were all trapped in this I guess he says that her brilliance was to call it the problem that has no name and then give it a name, The Feminine Mystique.
Nice. So this is one of those books that, like, you lived through all of this and now you have a different lens to see
exactly.
it
Exactly. That's exactly right.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
All right. The Free World, Art and Thought in the Cold War by Louis Menon. I can't remember how you said it.
I said Menon, but it couldn't be Menon.
All right. I was just making it up.
Tomato.
Tim, what's next on your nonfiction list?
This book fascinated me, and I cannot explain exactly why. It's called Come Fly the World, The Jet Age Story of the Women of Pan Am by Julia Cook. She's a journalist. This is her second book, but she is the daughter of a Pan Am executive, and she has just looked at the heyday of Pan Am from like the 1966 to 75, when it was sort of the gold standard of international travel, and looks at the women who worked as stewardesses there. And I have to tell you, just to read from the jacket, she was required to have a college education, speak two languages, possess the political savvy of a foreign service officer, and she had to be between 5'3 and 5'9, between 105 and 140 pounds, and at the age of 36 was forced to quit.
Oh, I just want to scream.
I just want to scream, too. I thought, why would these women put up with it? If you changed your hair, you had to have management approval.
Oh.
But these women were able to see the world, were able to travel on their own, were able to get out of the kitchen, and they just, she follows four stewardesses through their careers and just gets a chance to see what drove them to accept these restrictions in exchange for what they got on the other side. She kind of busts the myth about stewardesses being party girls. They really weren't. And also it culminates, three or four stewardesses that she follows through their career, they never met until they all met on one flight that was flying children out of Vietnam in the fall of Saigon. And it is one of the most moving, harrowing chapters
wow.
I've ever read. These were smart women, and I think it's just time to read about how amazing they were. And if you're traveling by air, you should read this book because it will change your whole perspective.
All right. Come Fly the World, The Jet Age Story of the Women of Pan Am by Julia Cook. And Hunter, what's your first nonfiction pick?
So I had A Little Devil in America by Hanif Abdurraqib, which is a book of sort of essays dealing with black performance in America, and then how those, like the black performance, influences the kind of culture at large. So he talks a lot about Aretha Franklin and James Brown and Otis Redding and Beyonce, and about sort of large performances that they had given, and also just very kind of small ones that he experienced when he was kind of discovering them, and you know, and he ties in his own kind of personal background growing up in I think it's Columbus, Ohio, definitely in and just how, yeah, these performances influences the greater culture. But he just grabs the like the nostalgia of how music affects us really, really well. And you see it in his other books, too. And I think that it's kind of come to he's just honed it in on this one. And, yeah, it's just a very fascinating book.
All right. A Little Devil in America, Hanif Abdurraqib. And I just saw the preview for Questlove's documentary Summer of Soul about Harlem's Black Woodstock, and now I want to read this book and see that film together. Oh, yeah. That sounds perfect. All right, Jan, what's next on your list?
Well, next I'm going to talk about, since I'm talking about the Cold War, I'm going to talk about Mark Harris's biography of Mike Nichols, the director, which actually I came to because I read like a 4-page review of it in the New Yorker by Louis Menand. But then it's just really great. And Mike Nichols was born in Berlin in 1931, and his family escaped. They were Jewish, and they escaped to New York. And his father was a doctor who died. And he, rather than go to college, he was very bright. Rather than go to college in at Columbia or something, he went to the University of Chicago, which was something that, you know, that's where Philip Roth, I mean, he met Susan Sontag on his first day of college, and they were lifelong friends.
Wow.
And, but then he also met Elaine May, that he did this stand-up stuff with.
Nichols and May, yep.
Oh, my God, you got to Google. Like, Google especially one about you've got to call, why don't you call your mother?
Yep.
It's so funny. But anyway, they became giantly famous in their 20s doing the stand-up stuff. They were selling out all these places in New York, and Elaine May said, I just can't do this for the rest of my life. I've got to change. And which caused a rupture between them for a while. But so then, you know, he got into theater and movies. And one of the best scenes in the book, obviously, is when he's directing The Graduate. And the studio wanted to cast Robert Redford. And it's so amazing that Dustin Hoffman gets to play a WASP in this movie, but you know, he had seen Dustin Hoffman like in theater off Broadway, and he wanted him for this role.
That's so, my Benjamin. Yep.
So Nichols brings Redford into the studio and says to him, "When was the last time you had trouble getting a girl?" And Robert Redford goes, "What do you mean?" And he says to the producers, "See," and they choose Dustin Hoffman. But it's just full of stuff like that, and amazing, amazing life story.
All right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mike Nichols, A Life by Mark Harris. Tim, your turn.
Well, I'm going to talk about the new book by Daniel James Brown, the author of The Boys in the Boat, which everyone will probably remember. It became a PBS special and was a huge bestseller. This is called Facing the Mountain, The True Story of Japanese American Heroes in World War II. He follows the lives that begins on Pearl Harbor, and he follows four Japanese American young men, three who go into the army and fight in Europe, horrible fighting in Italy and Germany and France, and then one who refuses the draft and becomes sort of a figurehead of civil liberties and anti-discrimination, going through a series of court cases and prison time. And that particular young man ends up marrying an American girl, which causes all kinds of problems. But it is a very timely book because of the rise of anti-Asian sentiment, because of the pandemic. And I think it's important to remember that we're all Americans. These guys fought for our country even while their families were in internment camps. And it just is I'm going to get emotional talking about it. We need to read this book. And it's a great summer book. It's about 500 pages. And his research and his writing is spectacular.
Facing the Mountain, A True Story of Japanese American Heroes in World War II by Daniel James Brown. And Hunter, that brings us to you.
So I had Float Like a Butterfly, Drink Mint Tea by Alex Wood, which is a recovery memoir of sorts. But Alex Wood is also a comedian living in Canada, and so then it's funny. And he battles his addictions to drugs and alcohol, largely through drinking mint tea and boxing, which is where the title comes from. And in the process of kind of trying to quit drugs and alcohol, he also kind of realizes that he has other addictions. So he quits, you know, tries to quit everything basically, and quits smoking and quits caffeine, sugar, I think, and you know, biting his nails. He sort of just realizes that he has one of those people that just does everything to, in excess. And he had had problems, you know, kind of overeating when he was younger and stuff like that. And but because he's a comedian, it's you just laugh out loud at times, but while also not being, like, it's intended for you to laugh at him and kind of all the poor choices that he made. And he's not kind of talking up, you know, his addictions and being an alcoholic and stuff like that. But it's, yeah, very funny.
Well, another book that may sound really cathartic to a lot of people coming out of the year that we just had, Float Like a Butterfly, Drink Mint Tea. There's a subtitle to that that I can't read on the air, so by Alex Wood. And now we're down to the lightning round again. So give me just one line about everything. Jan, what's your next pick?
We Are What We Eat, A Slow Food Manifesto by Alice Waters. And, you know, it's about what it says it's about. But she's so thorough in talking about our culture and how you don't have to be rich or an elitist to be able to afford slow food. And actually, the cost of it ends up being less. And your life is so changed if you eat and cook yourself and garden. And I will just give a quick plug for Carl Klaus, who has a book coming out in September, so you can't read it yet. But he has been living this life for probably 30 or 40 years, and his books are the perfect example of what she's talking
all
about.
Right. That sounds great. And I'm sure a lot of people are going to want to get this one. We Are What We Eat, A Slow Food Manifesto by Alice Waters. Tim.
The last choice is called Why Peacocks? By Sean Flynn, An Unlikely Search for Meaning in the World's Most Magnificent Bird. Sean is a journalist. His first book, he lived with his wife and two small boys in North Carolina, and he gets a text from a friend of his saying, "You want three peacocks? Come over and get them." And he's like, "Do I want three peacocks?" And his wife says, "We'll take them." So it is really the odyssey of having these peacocks in your, he expects these magnificent birds, but really there's a little, you know, they're a lot like chickens and turkeys. They look great, but there is some care. And it's just the family odyssey of raising these birds. And you get a history of peacocks and how they're affecting his life. You will laugh hysterically and learn a lot about peacocks. It's a fun, fun read.
All right, I'm sold. Why Peacocks? An Unlikely Search for Meaning in the World's Most Magnificent Bird by Sean Flynn. And your final pick, Hunter?
I've got What Happened to Paula by Catherine Dykstra, which tells, it's a true crime sort of memoir book that talks about the killing of Paula Oberbrockling from Cedar Rapids and the cold case in that. And then the author goes back and kind of tries to dig up the loose ends and stuff to it, but while also sort of, she sees similarities between herself and Paula and their upbringings, and then kind of goes in to kind of discuss about if Paula were to have been raised on the sort of the other side of the women's rights movement, if things would have been different. And then also, while also kind of lamenting the countless similarities and how little progress is kind of seems to have been made between when she was alive and when, like, the current day when Catherine is writing the book. But yeah, it's very good.
All right. What Happened to Paula by Catherine Dykstra, with a very strong Iowa connection there. And we are out of time, but in this last minute, I know it's been a very difficult year for the bookselling business. It's been a very difficult year for everybody. Jan, how is Prairie Lights doing? How are you guys?
We didn't reopen until our staff was fully vaccinated, which was about a month ago, mid-May. And we are amazed at how people have missed the store and how they're coming in, and it hasn't stopped. It's been really great.
Oh,
so we're very,
so good,
we're
to
very
hear.
Grateful for, and for all the people that supported us during the pandemic, which were many.
Hunter, how are things at Beaverdale Books?
It's good. Yeah, we're just another month out. We waited. All of our staff was vaccinated kind of the middle of April, and so we opened April 13th. And even, yeah, being a month previous, it's still the same outpouring of support.
Oh,
it hasn't stopped, and everybody's happy to just be back inside. And you forgot how much you missed just the conversations either that you have with customers or even the ones that you overhear between customers talking about books. And it's just been amazing.
That's so good. Well, go to your local bookstore and travel to a few others as well. Hunter Gillum of Beaverdale Books, Jan Weissmiller, and Tim Budd of Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe.
Brilliant novels, groundbreaking nonfiction, evocative poetry, great books, and insightful conversations whenever you want them on the Talk of Iowa Book Club podcast. Pick the books that speak to you or read them all. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.